ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
I offer my respectful obeisances to His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada and to all of you, because you are Vaishnavas and therefore the most worshipable in the three worlds. Hare Krishna. So, in the teachings of Rupa Goswami, the advice given is that one should take shelter of Krishna through a process. So, to get anything done in life, we need to have a process so that we can move our senses in a certain direction. And in the teachings of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he describes how there's a progression in advancement in devotional service, beginning with the development of faith. And much of this comes about by the mercy of those who are distributing Krishna consciousness to others. Someone might show up at your door by Krishna's arrangement and give you an opportunity to look into one of the Vaishnava scriptures as an example. And because of what you read, you might become interested in Krishna consciousness. Possible? This is an example of outside influence. Someone came into your environment and gave you something. Generally, this is done by devotees who are interested in distributing Krishna's mercy to others. They're classified as madhyama adhikaris, or those in the middle position. And they actually organize their life around this principle, and they relate to people with the idea that I will make friendship with devotees. I'll make a sangha, which means there is an attachment for devotees, and that I will be on the lookout for those people who are a little bit open to Krishna consciousness, and I'll be ready to give them as much opportunity as possible to take to Krishna consciousness. They think all the time, how can I give more mercy to others? And then they're also aware that there are people in the world that aren't interested in Krishna consciousness, and they're careful not to interfere in their lives and make them more inimical. And then, of course, there's Krishna, whom they're aware of, and they do everything that they can to develop their love for Krishna. So these madhyama adhikaris come in contact with people, and they give them an opportunity to hear about Krishna, to do some service, and so forth. And sooner or later, people develop a sense that I like devotional service. This is a very fortunate situation for any living entity, because as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Bahunam janmanamante gyanavamam prapadyate vasudeva sarvamiti sa mahatma sudurlabha. The essence of faith or shraddha is this third line in the verse, vasudeva sarvamiti, that I consider that Krishna, Vasudeva, God, is the main purpose of my life. This type of feeling awakens in the heart of somebody who's gotten some mercy by the connection with sadhus, those who are practicing devotional service and have a goal to reach Krishna. And when that faith awakens, there's something you want to do. For instance, when your faith in anything awakens, when you start to put your heart into something, then you're thinking, how can I be around people who are doing that? There are many kinds of causes in this world or disciplines. For instance, someone might take up kung fu, and then they're thinking, how can I find others who are doing kung fu? And they'll start watching kung fu matches on the computer, and maybe even go to a kung fu match to watch a kung fu master do kung fu. So you can pick any discipline, and the natural tendency would then be to be around those people who like sports. They'll actually wear the shirt of the person that they most admire. I see people walking to the Giants games when we drive past the stadium, and they'll have number 8. I don't know who number 8 is. I'm just picking numbers. I haven't followed the Giants since Willie Mays and Willie McCovey when I was a kid. But people identify and they go to the game and they'll wear the shirt and they'll take the paraphernalia that goes along with it. You should probably bring a glove to the stadium and whatever else, a little flag or something. So this is a natural tendency. So in devotional service, when once someone's faith awakens and they're thinking Vasudeva Sarvamiti, the main thing in life is Vasudeva Krishna, then they'll look for people who are interested in Vasudeva Krishna. Because otherwise, it's a little hard to relate with others, because just like sometimes you hear somebody saw a UFO somewhere. Like, you know, you might read in a paper someone, they had this experience, the guy went in his backyard and he saw there was a UFO. And then he runs in to tell everybody, and I'm saying, Larry, shut up, you know. So Larry has to go find a group that believes in UFOs, because they're the only people who listen to him. So they go. Larry goes there, and you know, then you saw a UFO. I saw a UFO. So, you know, the chances of becoming Krishna conscious in this world nowadays are like chances of seeing a UFO. Very rare. And so people, they're looking for that rarefied kind of association. Where can I go? You had that experience? You saw it? You feel it? Vasudeva Sarvamiti? Yeah, okay. Then let's talk and let's do some bhajan. And that's the next thing called bhajana kriya. Kriya means to do something. So you really have to do something to prove that you're into something. And the bhajana kriya, it doesn't necessarily mean that you've developed love for God. You're doing a preliminary, you're doing the activity, even though you may not even be fully realized in it, but it's given as an entry point for everyone, bhajana kriya. Here's something for you to do to practice devotional service. And this is the beginning, because in the beginning, someone tells you, here are the things that you should do that are favorable for devotional service. And even they may seem a little different or foreign to you, you accept it, because there's a sense that these people are following the tradition. They have teachers who are following the tradition, and they've read the scriptures more than me. They know what the process is. So then they start practicing bhajana kriya. And then when one starts practicing, it means there's some kind of a commitment. Then there's the experience of dealing with the obstacles that come up in the practice, and called anartha nivritti, or the clearing away of those obstacles, may take some time. And in the process of doing that, there's a kind of a direction. Actually, throughout the scriptures, there are various stages or steps that one can take to help keep one on the path. And there's a description of what it means to take shelter of Krishna more and more. So there's a very practical point about what we call surrender or sharanagati, the process of taking shelter of Krishna. So in the first stage, there's a way that one will accept those things that are favorable for the practice of devotional service. And those are described in one song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who says, Shuddha Bhakata Charana Renu Bhajana Anukula. So he's saying that the root of the creeper of bhakti is association with devotees, with sadhus. And he goes on throughout the song telling about all the things that are favorable. In fact, it's written in a section of his book on Sharanagati, in which he's describing, here are all the favorable things that you can do. Everyone needs to have something positive that they can do. That's why it's called bhajana kriya. You're doing some bhajan. And so he describes those things. It's not that you can just stop doing the things that are not favorable, because then what are you going to do instead? That's not possible. Krishna says in the Gita that you can't stop acting even for a moment. If you sit down and say, I'm not doing that anymore, it'll still keep calling to you from across the room, because your mind is still attached to it. So one has to have some engagement. Anya bilashita shunyam jnana karma nyanavritam anukulyena krishna nushilanam bhakti ruchate. The description of pure devotional service uses this verb, shil, which means to cultivate. You actually have to cultivate something, just like when you're cultivating a garden. there's activities that you have to do. Now, he goes on, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his song about how there are places that you can go to see that are related to Lord Chaitanya. And he says, I take pleasure in going to these places where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sat and did his pastimes. For instance, if you go to the on the route in South India where Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went when he walked by himself or with one servant through South India, you'll find that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur set up a little shrine in each place. And there he put the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And for Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we'll go there. There you are in South India in this very enriched atmosphere. And then you see your own Lord Chaitanya's lotus feet there. And you feel happy that, oh, look, Mahaprabhu was here. You feel, and you can remember the pastime. This is very favorable, he says. Then he talks about how if you observe festivals like Janmashtami, he said, this is very favorable. You know, it gives you a time when you can throw a big party. Everybody likes parties, but actually they go downhill fast if Krishna's not in the center. They tend towards the mode of ignorance, and they're actually not that satisfying ultimately. People come and talk about themselves at parties. Well, how are you doing? Oh, I'm okay. Let me tell you all my problems. And or they exaggerate about how they're doing, and everyone puts on a facade. So although there's the trappings of a party, and you have cake and ice cream and who knows what else, it's not very satisfying. But if you have a party for Krishna, then you feel satisfied. In fact, that's mostly what's going on in the spiritual world, is a festival atmosphere. And so you can do that for Krishna, and this is one of the favorable things that you can do. And then he talks about worshiping Tulsi Devi. The human mind can't comprehend how it would be that Tulsi Devi would be a goddess from the spiritual world. In fact, the first time I walked in the temple in the morning program, and everyone's going around Tulsi, and I thought, now this is cool. I don't understand it, but it's totally cool. This place is for me. You know, they're walking around Tulsi singing. I mean, who does that in the middle of Silicon Valley or San Francisco or New York? Like, what'd you do this morning? We worshiped a plant. It's otherworldly. But it's favorable to devotional service, and you don't know it until you keep Tulsi in your house. You chant in front of Tulsi. You walk around Tulsi. You water Tulsi. And if you're picking Tulsi leaves, it's very a transcendental experience because you're picking them to offer to Krishna. And there's this relationship, Krishna and Tulsi, and then you smell the Tulsi also when you're offering it to Krishna. And it pervades, and it gets into your nose, your ears, your eyes, everything. So he goes through and he mentions all these favorable things. He says, you can do these things, and then you'll feel happy in devotional service. It's part of what is called doing things favorable in devotional service. So if you adopt these habits, then they'll be very uplifting. And then he says there's things to not do. And there's a list, actually, a handy list in the Nectar of Instruction. And Rupa Goswami laid them out. He says, Atyahara Prayashyascha. So Atyahara means overdoing it. And we say Ahara means eating, so don't eat too much. You shouldn't think you need to get fat for Krishna. Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavatam, it's not helpful. In the process of devotional service, senses get overloaded. Don't eat too much. And also don't engage your senses in anything too much. And just as if you eat all kinds of bad stuff, then you're going to get sick. And if you look at all kinds of bad stuff, then your mind's going to get sick too. And any of your senses can be overloaded with junk. In fact, people get really ill if they eat bad things, and they get mentally ill if they expose their senses to bad things. So Atyahara, don't overdo it on the senses, be balanced. And Prayashas means don't over-endeavor. I mean, there's a lot of ways that you can over-endeavor, even in devotional service. You take on projects that are way too big for you, and then you might find yourself 24 hours a day just running to deal with every single problem. Acharyas can deal with this, like they have capacity, but every devotee is not meant to torture themselves to death by overdoing, find a pace that you can handle so that you can actually do your bhajan properly and then do the kinds of service that feels natural to you that you can do, but don't overdo it. Prayashascha. And prajalpo, don't use your tongue to speak gossip, because it's very distracting, and generally it degrades into criticizing other people. Prajalpo niyamas. What's the next one? Niyamagraha. And also, don't do devotional service just for the sake of doing it. Be aware that you're doing it when you're doing it, and put your heart into it. Actually figure out what you're doing also. There's ways in which you can be doing some of the practice of devotional service and not even know why you're doing it or what the words mean and things like that. It's more helpful to know what you're doing. And also don't not do it either, because that's also a way that you can drift away from devotional service by just stopping to do it. And then it goes one day, and then 3 days, 6 days, and then you got a month, and then a year. And there's also janasangas, which means don't associate with worldly-minded people. And then you might think, well, I have every day I got to go to school, and I'm hanging around worldly-minded people, or you got to go to work. But janasangas means don't become attached to that kind of association. In other words, you may be there, but don't invest your heart in it, because that's when you get in trouble, and you'll start taking on the qualities of those who are janasangas, they're worldly-minded. These are some of the things that Rupa Goswami says to avoid. So on one hand, there's positive things to take up, and on the other side, there's things that you can avoid to feel satisfied. And now you can get Satyadeva Prabhu's chair and bring him up here, and we'll have an interview process. And I'll ask him about things that are favorable or unfavorable in his life, and he'll ask me questions too that I'll have to answer. It's kind of like a talk show. Well, Satyadeva Prabhu, welcome to the Wednesday evening talk show here at ISKCON of Silicon Valley.
Thanks for having me.
He needs a mug or something over here.
I have a mug.
Satyadeva, I was curious to know, what is the most favorable thing that you do every day that helps you to keep the momentum in your practice of devotional service? What would you say?
The most favorable thing I do is to look at a picture of Srila Prabhupada and say thank you. And to not in a routine way, but remember what I'm grateful for that I've gotten, and that I have another day to chant Hare Krishna and to be on the path of awakening and developing my soul purpose, you know, for being here.
When did you first develop this practice of saying thank you to a picture of Srila Prabhupada?
I really can't remember. It's just always been that way for me. Maybe because that was my introduction to Krishna consciousness. Like, you know, I've told many times, but when I came to Krishna consciousness, I'd never read a book before, or I'd never heard the Hare Krishna mantra, and I'd only met a devotee the day before. And then the next day I met Srila Prabhupada, and then all at once I, you know, received the Hare Krishna mantra and the teaching that that God is a person and that he's blue and he plays a flute. And that was a great relief for me. I remember when Giriraj Swami was here and he was talking about how he had a sign on his wall saying, "You are God." I didn't have a sign on my wall saying I was God, but I had that confusion. I had heard that, and I was kind of cynical again when it came to religion and religious beliefs. And so things weren't clear to me, but I think subtly I had this idea that everything is God. But at the same time, I was conflicted because I was desperate to know God and I was praying to God, and it was a contradiction, right? If you're God, then why are you praying to God? So somehow when I met Srila Prabhupada and I met the devotees, right away all that became cleared up, and I knew this was the truth that I had been seeking, and seeking was over. What a relief.
Now,
so that's one of the things I'm grateful for when I see Srila Prabhupada. That's one of the things I'm grateful for when I look at a picture of Srila Prabhupada. I'm grateful that I'm not seeking anymore.
You once told me that when you read the Shirish Upanishad and you heard the verse, or you heard the in Prabhupada's purport, he says that all forms of incompleteness are due to incomplete knowledge of the complete whole. That really captured your attention. Can you just describe the moment that you read that? Where were you? Where did you get the Shirish Upanishad? And how did you feel when you read that one sentence?
I actually don't remember that exact moment. I don't remember reading any of Srila Prabhupada's books until about 3 or 4 months later. Although I joined the temple, I was in Tokyo, we didn't really read very much. We didn't have classes or anything.
But you told me that line caught your attention.
I must have been in San Francisco. I went to San Francisco after Tokyo, and that's when I first started reading, and the first book I read was Isho Panasad, and that verse and that purport gave me all the information I needed, even till this day, to understand that God is a person, that I'm not God, and that I'm his servant, that I'm one. We're one with God, but we're also different. And that that's Lord Chaitanya's teaching, Achinta, Abheda Bheda Tattva, and to me, it's the perfect, all-inclusive, comprehensive description of the absolute truth.
Now, you say you went to the San Francisco temple. Tell us what it looked like. What did the temple look like? What did it smell like? What was the state of the temple? I'm assuming you're talking about Valencia Street, 355 Valencia.
If I'm not incorrect,
455 Valencia. And you were driven to the temple, you were dropped off, you took a bus, you walked in. Who was there? What did it look like?
Well, my visa had run out, and I was in Japan, and the visa had expired. And believe it or not, in those days, it was cheaper to go by boat than it was to fly by airplane. And I just had enough money to get a boat ticket. I forget the name of the...
Jaladuta.
Anyway, I took a boat from Yokohama to San Francisco. I remember my parents were there to greet me. They couldn't believe that I actually came back. And my best friend, Dan McGuffin. And I went home and I told them all about my journeys. And I said, and by the way, I'm leaving home again and I'm going to the San Francisco temple, which is not too far away. And so the next day, I went to the San Francisco temple, which had just moved from Frederick Street to 455 Valencia Street. And they had, I don't think they had been there a week. They just moved in, and it was previously it was a funeral home. Maybe you've all heard that. I remember it had red carpet on the bottom floor, and the stairs that you remember the stairs that go up, that all had red carpet. And I remember meeting Jayananda right away, and Keshava, and said I just came from Tokyo. I'm a new devotee, Bhakta Matthew. I wasn't initiated yet. And I remember they immediately put me to work in the upstairs. In the upstairs was the embalming room. I remember the embalming tables that were there, and the sink on the floor. And they put me to work right away. I was working there with Jayananda, removing the embalming tables and cleaning out the drain system. Pretty gross. And that was the state of the temple. There was no temple. There was nothing. Everything was just in the state of being deconstructed.
Did you live inside?
Yes. Everyone lived on the second floor. There were a few women. I don't remember where the Brahmacharini ashram was. There was probably about 20 Brahmacharis. And there was a big floor upstairs. And personally, we only had our sleeping bag. And everyone had, there were dhotis, there were no kurtas, there were t-shirts and sweatshirts, and not actually Indian dhotis, but material from a fabric shop.
Polyester.
And we didn't really own them. At the end of the day, we put whatever we were wearing into a big pile, and someone did the laundry at the laundromat. I used to do that quite often. And then the pile of clean clothes would come back, and everyone would pick something and put that on. That's how we lived. And I don't remember, there was the Mongol Arctic. There wasn't a regular Guru Puja or a regular Bhagavatam class. And I think I started reading Ishopanishads with Jayananda Prabhu, because he used to chant it every day before Mangal Artik, as he sat in front of the altar waiting for the deity doors to open. And at nighttime we had hot milk after a long day, 2 days of 2 hours, two sessions of Harinam, morning session and evening session. We come back and have hot milk and read the Nectar of Devotion, which had just come out. Otherwise, devotees didn't read too much. There were a few scholarly types that I remember. One devotee, I can't remember his name, but he was reading the Bhagavatam and memorizing verses. And I'd never met anyone else who did that at that time. Mm. In fact, we learned one verse together and we chanted it out on Harinam.
What is the verse?
Atma Ramas Chamunio Nirgunta Apiukrame. How's it go? Kurvanti Ahaituki Vaktim Itam Bhuta Gunahari. That's the first
verse. And you used to chant
verse.
That out on the street?
Yeah, we chanted it out on Harinam because of this one devotee.
Now, I'm going to read a verse, because you had mentioned the way in which you had seen that there were different impersonal ways of describing God. Some people, you had mentioned how Guru Raj Swami had said he had a sign that said, "You are God," and that there was a lot of that going around, right?
Right.
And so this is a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, in which Krishna, in text number 14, describes devotees. And he says that they're always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me. These great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. In the next verse, which is 9:15, he says, Jnana yagnina chapyanya yajanto mam upasate ikatvena pritaktvena bahuda vishvato mukham. Translation is, others who engage in sacrifice for the cultivation of knowledge worship the Supreme Lord as the one without a second, as diverse in many, and in the universal form. And here's the purport. This verse is the summary of the previous verses. The Lord tells Arjuna that those who are purely in Krishna consciousness and do not know anything other than Krishna are called Mahatma. Yet there are other persons who are not exactly in the position of Mahatma, but who worship Krishna also in different ways. Some of them have already been described as the distressed, the financially destitute, the inquisitive, and those who are engaged in the cultivation of knowledge. But there are others who are still lower, and these are divided into three. So there's a class, or four classes of devotees that Krishna had mentioned in the seventh chapter of the Gita, where he says, Chaturvida bhajante mam jana sukritino arjuna arto jignaso artarti jnani cha paritarshaba. The famous verse, and Krishna describes there's four kinds of people who begin worshiping me, and he says that they're pious because they have some sukriti accumulated, and when they're in various situations in their life, for instance, they're in need of wealth, or they're in suffering condition, where they're very inquisitive, then they take to the process of devotional service. And before that, he had described four kinds of people who don't take to Krishna consciousness. Does anybody remember the four? Just before Chaturvida Bhajanti Mam, he says, these are pious people that take to devotional service. There's four kinds of people that don't take to devotional service. Namam duskritinu mada prapadyante naradama maya pritagyana asuram bhavamashrita. So these are four categories of people. They have a mentality that's averse to God. Namam duskritinu. These are duskritinos. Their kriti means to do something, and du means bad, so they do bad stuff. Duskritinu mudha. So the first one's called the mudha. What is the mudha? You guys say, what is the characteristic? What animal is mostly connected to the mudha? What's wrong with a poor donkey? Why does everybody pick on the donkey? So, what does the donkey do? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with working hard? Go ahead and tell us. Huh?
He eventually gets the same amount of food and whatever, but he'll work very hard to get that, which he would probably get even without working hard.
Because it's growing, grass is growing on the side of the road, but he works carrying big loads for a master, even though, because the master is like holding it in front of his face, saying, you work hard, I'll give you a little grass. But he doesn't know he could just wander off and eat grass by himself, right? So the mudha, namam duskriti mudha, prapadyante naradama. What about the naradama? What's the description? It's an open book quiz. You can look if you need to. Means? Nara Dhamma. Didn't have any principles. Lowest among mankind means? What's the description? Go ahead, you got it.
Lowest among mankind is, there are many kind of men, those are interested to follow Krishna consciousness, they have devotional, they want to do devotion. Lowest kind of man in comes in this verse, it can be related to person who not interested, they are just interested for sanctification and not interested in worshipping or realizing about spirit and body and soul and understanding about Krishna consciousness.
Okay. Naradama, duskritino, mudhas. Duskritina Naradama is the lowest of mankind. Nara means human being, and Adama means the lowest. Out of 8,400,000 different species of living beings, there are 400,000 human species. Out of these, there are numerous lower forms of human life that are mostly uncivilized. The civilized human beings are those who have regulative principles of social, political, and religious life. Those who are socially and politically developed but who have no religious principles must be considered Nardamas. Nor is religion without God religion, because the purpose of following religious principles is to know the supreme truth and man's relationship with him. And then the next category is called Maya Pritagyana, and these are highly learned people, but because they have theories about God that disparage him or put him in a position of not being God at all, for instance, Prabhupada gives the example, someone might say, well, it's not to Krishna to whom one should surrender, it's to the unborn within Krishna. So they speculate and they reduce God to some unborn amorphous force that isn't actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So with all their intelligence and development of academic writings and so forth, they miss the point completely. And then finally, asuram, asuram bhavamashrita, demoniac principles. They're openly atheistic. So in any words, there's categories of people, and then the next category Krishna describes are those who are pious and they surrender to Krishna and under different circumstances. And now he says, besides these, here are several other categories. So, but there are others who are still lower, and these are divided into the three. He who worships himself as one with the Supreme Lord, he who concocts some form of the Supreme Lord and worships that, and he who accepts the universal form, the Vishva Rupa, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and worships that. Out of the above three, the lowest, those who worship themselves as the Supreme Lord, thinking themselves to be monists, are most prominent. Such people think themselves to be the Supreme Lord, and in this mentality they worship themselves. This is also a type of God worship, for they can understand that they are not the material body, but actually spirit soul. At least, such a sense is prominent. Generally, the impersonalists worship the Supreme Lord in this way. Would you like to comment on that class? Have you ever met anybody that felt like that? Or have you experienced it yourself, that kind of philosophy?
I encounter it a lot. And I think there are a lot of teachers out there today who teach that, not only maybe not so directly or so consciously, especially teachers, you know, coming from India are teaching that you are God, we are God, but they never ask the question that Prabhupada often asks, that if you are God, then how did you ever forget it?
Does anybody remember where that argument came from originally, that defeats the idea of the Mayavad philosophy that we just heard as a hint over the weekend? I can't exactly hear what you're saying, but it all sounds like you're guessing. Remember how he told how there were seven tenets, and Ramanujacharya gave these ironclad ways in which to defeat Mayavad, and the last one, Radhika Raman said, this is the strongest of all of them, that Prabhupada uses it all the time. Kadukarnika's come alive, he's rallying.
So he says this gives sense humors in the sense quakes in the shoes of the Mayavadis whenever we say this argument.
Yeah, they quake in their shoes when they hear this.
So the argument is, where does Maya live? Where is Maya live exactly if everything is Brahman and Brahman has no attributes?
Yes, and specifically what Satyadeva Prabhu said, that okay, then if you're God, then how did you fall under illusion? right?
I'm always amazed, even after all of these years, anytime I hear one of these teachers or I read something on the internet where that's being spoken or someone even brings that up, they never ask that question. Nobody asked that question.
I think we all felt over the weekend, because the seminar was so well structured and the points were so well delivered, that it gave us, it left us with a sense of responsibility that these arguments are so commonsensical and powerful and helpful to anyone who's trying to cultivate spiritual life, that it's important for us to present those to the world.
That was Sri the Prabhupada's argument to Giriraj Swami as well. I mean, at the end, that's what he was pointing to, I think, and that convinced Giriraj Swami.
How did God become not God?
Yeah,
because real God never becomes not God.
That's the same question.
God.
How right. did God not?
Yeah, then illusion is more powerful than God. Then that he wasn't God in the first place, right? Yeah. Okay, so where were we? Was I asking you something and you answered? What? Yeah, the first kind of person. So Satyadeva Prabhu was saying that it's very prominent. It's worked its way into the psyche of people, just as much as you find the idea of evolution very much prominent. I was looking at a biology textbook the other day, and I just noticed the first two points are about chemical evolution. And there's a way in which people who are writing about self-help or anything will somewhere, anywhere in the book, they'll come up with this theory that actually at one point we had evolved into cavemen or something, and that we're foraging and things like that, and that was on our way up, and that's why we still have certain instincts and things like that. That's become ubiquitous. And similarly, this idea about how we're all God ultimately has become ubiquitous also. People don't even know where they got it from in the first place. They haven't studied the... It's just become pervasive, right? Mm. So it's one of the points in which Srila Prabhupada stressed that one should overcome this idea and come to the point of understanding that, as you said before, from Om Purnam Adapurnaminam, you said... there is a God, I'm not him.
Yeah.
That's kind of very advanced stage. Because then you have the wherewithal to surrender and actually apply these principles in earnest, that I'm feeling naturally happy because I can now enact my surrender because I know my position. This is called Sambandha Gyan. Without knowing that, if I'm thinking I am God, how much can I put my heart into surrendering to God? It seems a little contradictory anyway, doesn't it? But if I have this sense that God is all-powerful and I'm not, I'm a part of him and I'm his servant, then one could put one's whole heart and soul into the surrender process.
Yeah, yeah. Bhakti cannot arise, really, without us understanding our position.
That's a nice way to put that. It's so, and I would assume then, if I was to carry that thought further, that if I were to create an environment in which I had the proper context and understand my relationship to him, Sambandha Gyan, then it would naturally begin to arise, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, Haridasa Thakur, he mentions in the Harinam Chintamani that one cannot really develop much in the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra without having a clear understanding of what is the soul and what is God. If there's some confusion there, that will be an obstacle to advancing.
But
if that obstacle is removed through proper knowledge that comes through the disciplic succession, then one has full access.
What's to stop anybody,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Full freedom to surrender.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's continue in the purport. Prabhupada writes here, the second class includes the worshippers of the demigods, those who by imagination consider any form to be the form of the Supreme Lord. So this is a kind of idea, yatamat tatapat, whatever you want to worship, you can create any kind of idea of what God it looks like, and it doesn't matter where you worship, because it all leads to the same place. How prominent is that?
I only find it mostly in India, not so much outside of India.
Any of you have experience of this? And if so, in what form have you seen it? That just create a form and worship any form. Yeah? Anywhere in Bengal?
Yes. Ramakrishna Mission, you know, a lot of followers I find there. And now that they know that I am into this Krishna consciousness, so they'll tell me, you know, the main thing is you remain humble. So I know Krishna can be the great, but don't everybody, it's the same. Don't look down on others. The same thing. Whomever you worship, you'll eventually, you know.
Same thing.
Yeah, don't be too arrogant that, okay, Krishna. That's how some of them, you know, some of my elderly relatives, when I go there once in a while, they'll put in my ears and then I just kind of ignore. So, yeah.
Now, of course, we read in the Sri Upanishad, yastu sarvani bhutani atmani vanupashyati sarva bhuteshu chatmanam tato na vijugupsate yasmin sarvani bhutani atmai vadbhut vichanataha tatrako mahakashoka ekatvamanupashyataha. There is a way in which a person on topmost level does see God everywhere and also doesn't condescend to anybody. But it's a different kind of vision, isn't it, that's being described? Right? It's not. Can anybody over here in the pundit pit describe the difference between what Shambhalangi said, that everyone's God in the same way, and what the Sri Upanishad says, anupashyati? One should see how everything's in relationship to the Supreme Lord and sees the Supreme Lord everywhere. What is the difference, would you say? I see Bart's being delegated. Like, what is it about those verses of Sri Upanishad? What is it directing us to specifically? And, you know, what are we seeing that's worshipable in all living beings?
Well, in the Sri Upanishad, it's not saying that the living beings are God themselves, but they have qualities that God has, but God has all the qualities.
That's a really good point. And in fact, this is something that Radhika Raman Prabhu brought up in the seminar. He was saying the Upanishads are the first transcendental part of the Vedas. Before that, you get rituals for material elevation and adjustment in the material world and so forth. But then the Upanishads say, actually, there's something beyond just the three modes of material nature, Trigunya Vishaya Veda, Nishtrigunya Vibharjuna. But when somebody's coming out of the material experience, where do you point them so they can actually get a sample of what the Supreme Personality of Godhead is like? Where's the place that you would look to find out the quality of the Supreme? It's the same thought process you're engaging in now, so just say, what's the answer to that?
I was a little confused by the question.
Okay, well, let me give you the answer, and then maybe the question will make sense. The answer is that you would look at yourself. And the reason you'd look at yourself is not because you're God, but because you're part and parcel of God. And you're the same quality. You're not the same quantity, but you can look at a sample. Hence the word sample was the giveaway in this SAT question. And so there's a way in which if you examine yourself and you see, like, you have certain qualities that are categorically different from matter, and then they say, like, that's what God's like. But then the Mayavadis will interpret that and they'll say, that means I am God. But that's not what the Sri Upanishad is saying, is it? Can you prove it from those verses? Like, what is the indication in any of those verses that we should be looking at God and not saying that I am God?
Yasmin sarvani bhutani atmai vavad vijanatha tatrako mohakashoka ekatva manipashita. That says that one who sees all living entities as spiritual sparks in quality one with the Lord becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? So it's saying that it's only a qualitative, not quantitative.
Hey, good. And what about the next verse? or the one before that?
Yasti sarvani bhutani atmani vanupashyati sarva bhuteshu chatmatam tatona vijigupshate. That says that he who sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, who sees all living entities as his parts and parcels, and who sees the Supreme Lord within everything, never hates anything nor any being.
Okay. You want to comment on that? Anybody?
So it's, again, it's not saying that they are God, it's saying that they're in relation to God.
Okay, good. Yeah, and there's a difference, and those, the second class includes the worship of demigods and those who imagine, consider any form to be the form of the Supreme Lord. And so the authorized scriptures are not saying that, but they're pointing to the fact that also the Supreme Lord is within every living being. But there's a difference between the living entity and the supreme living entity. There's an Atma and a Paramatma. And the metaphor that's often used from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad is that there's a tree, and within the tree there's two birds. So one is the eating bird and the other one is the witnessing bird. So the Paramatma is the bird who's detached. He's not interested in the three modes of material nature. Whereas the living entity, he's become enamored of the three modes and is eating there. And this question comes up also about making any form of the Supreme Lord and just worshiping that as God. Where else in the Gita do you think that comes up? Yes, Radhakripa Prabhu. He needs a mic fast.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, I was actually referring that 9.25,
yes,
where it says Yanti Deva Brata Devam Pitram Yanti Pitar Brata. So what it is saying that if you worship the demigods, you go to the demigods. If you worship Pitra, then you go to their land. If you worship me, you come to me. There's a clear distinction Krishna is making here already.
I think that's fascinating because it also proves the theory where attention goes, energy flows. It's a good to know wherever you're putting your attention, which really means worship. That means you're putting your whole heart into it. This is where I'm going to put my attention. You're going to end up there, right?
Right.
And you've also proved by quoting that verse, 9.25, that there's a distinction made. It's not that you all end up going in the same place.
Right.
Very nice citation. Excellent. Well done. Where else?
Sukeshwari Mataji just texted that my mom keeps telling me that Shiva, Vishnu, Sai Baba, everyone is the same.
Uh-huh.
So she just wanted to make a comment that...
Like, that this is happening in real time?
Yeah.
Yeah, so in the 17th chapter of the Gita, isn't it a conversation there where, Arjuna wants to know what happens, what is the destination of somebody who just imagines a certain type of worship, right? Since what if somebody makes something up and just worships that? And what does Krishna say? It's all the same? What does he say? Oh, go ahead. Feel free. It's open mic night.
Well, he says, Shraddha Mayoyam Puruso, like everyone is made of his faith, and according to his faith, he takes a different destination.
Yes, and he describes there in the 17th chapter how the original faith means a faith in God, in Krishna, and this clear understanding that there is a God and I'm not him, I'm his servitor. But when there's an influence by the three modes of material nature, different combinations and permutations, then I project my worship in different ways, and the result is very different. Very nicely proved by Yanti Deva Vrata Devan. So that's a thing, but it's this idea that you can worship any form and it gets to the same place, but it's not supported by Bhagavad Gita. And Bhagavad Gita is the gold standard of all pramanam.
Well, it's...
Yes.
You can, I think, in historically, you can trace back this belief that you can worship any demigod, whether it's Durga or Brahma or Shiva or Vishnu, and it's all the same. It traced back to Shankara's teaching. From that's how it was influenced, because that teaching is is that the material world actually doesn't exist. That it's just Maya, it's just an illusion, and there's just one Supreme. So if the Supreme appears as Kali, or if the Supreme appears as Brahma, that form is illusory. It's just the Supreme. So therefore, it doesn't matter which form you worship. And that's why people still have that belief.
Okay, now you just gave us Mayavad. Now you have to give us the cure.
Well, I think it's important to understand how that teaching has influenced India and is influencing the world today. And you can trace it back to that.
Somebody defeat it now, using what you heard from Radhika Raman's seminar over the weekend, because Satyadeva Prabhu just represented exactly what Radhika showed us was Shankar's philosophy. He gave it in a nutshell. So what's the antidote?
Gotcha.
Yeah. Feel free to quote Bhagavad Gita. Okay, Radhakripa Prabhu, he is red hot back there.
No, so I
center
think
the, field.
So okay, then the summary, I think Prabhu, he mentioned that first thing you should associate.
Oh, now, we're going to give extra credit or demerits for how you hold the mic.
Sorry.
These things, only the top half works. Okay, go ahead.
Radhika Prabhu actually mentioned that in the summary, what we should do. First thing he mentioned that we should reduce our screen time, because more you associate with the impersonalism, more you started deviating from the personalism itself. That's the first one I remember for sure.
Okay. He was talking about how impersonalism is pervasive, and that there's a way in which through mechanization, we tend to withdraw from personal interactions and more into screens. Mm. We roboticize everything so that people don't have to do it. We no longer interact with people. He was talking about how it becomes pervasive in that way. I would like to have a verse from the Bhagavad Gita to pull us out of this funk we've suddenly fallen into after hearing Mayavad philosophy from our dearly beloved Satyadeva Prabhu. He's begging us to give a verse to save us from the mire. Give a verse. Okay.
So,
yes.
One which I remember, I typically pray when I say, Yadadityam katam tejo jagat bhaste khilam, ya chandramasi cha chagnu ta tejo vidhi mamkam.
Yes.
When Krishna is telling in this one, this my loka is different from that, this. So he's already classifying it's different. So that means he exists somewhere. That is why it is different. So when he's taking my loka is separate, all the energy which comes to the Chandrama or the sun, it comes from me. And, so I see he's already classifying himself being a different. That means a person.
Okay, so he's distinguishing himself from the creation. Is that
right.
What you're saying?
Right.
Okay, but do you have more? If you have more, please tell more.
Yeah, so if all the gods are like, all the demigods are the names that we heard is same, then Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, he says, Matta Paratram Nanyat Kinchidasti Dhananjaya Mai Sarvam Idam Protam Sutre Maniganaiva. So he's clearly saying that there is nobody equal to or superior than me, and everything that you see here is like strung on a pulse, like all the, I'm the string that is holding everyone together.
Okay.
So that is one argument.
Okay. Continuing that argument, you might quote from the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, Yo yo yam yam tanum bhakta shradi architamichati tasyatasya chalam shadham tamiva vididham yaham. Right? Sataya shariya yuktastasya ardhanamihate labate cha tatakaman mayaiva vihitan hitan. There he's talking about Antavat tupalam te shantabhavat yalpamid sam devan deva yajo yanti yajanti yajanto mam upaisisi. No? Madbhakta yanti mam api. So in these three verses he says that, oh no, it's 7th chapter, go to text number 20, please. Thank you. Okay, translation is, those whose intelligence has been stolen by material desires surrender into demigods and follow the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their own natures. Next verse. I am in everyone's heart as the super soul. As soon as one desires to worship some demigod, I make his face steady so that he can devote himself to that particular deity. Next. Endowed with such a faith, he endeavors to worship a particular demigod and obtains his desires, but in actuality, these benefits are bestowed by me alone. This is pretty clear evidence, isn't it? That he's superior to the demigods. Next. And this is Antavat. Men of small knowledge worship the demigods, and their fruits are limited and temporary. Those who worship the demigods go to the planets of the demigods, but my devotees ultimately reach my supreme planet. Yes.
I can't remember which verse it is, but in one place Krishna says that eventually, even if you're making sacrifice for the demigods, it comes to me. Ultimately, it's for me. And I can't remember which chapter of Bhagavad.
They worship me in the wrong way. That's chapter 9.
Yeah. Shyavantite. And those who do not recognize my true transcendental knowledge fall down. 23. Yeah, so the verse we just saw, Ananyaschintayantamam, is really about when you meditate on Krishna, don't deviate from that. Ananyaschintayantamam. Actually, I just read a letter yesterday about a Prabhupada had written. It was kind of, this is a humorous circumstance. Satyadev can back me up on this. There were some sannyasis who were very charismatic, and they were also collecting a lot of money to give to Mayapur and to build Vrindavan and so forth. They had a party of devotees. Satyadev was on it. And they started, along with their deity worship, worshipping Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they started worshipping Ganesh also. Because after all, it says something in the nectar of devotion, you should worship Ganapati. So they started worshipping Ganapati. So then other devotees, because they kind of like looked up to these senior devotees, so they started emulating, and some of them started worshiping Ganesh, and one of them wrote to Prabhupada and said, can we worship Ganesh? You know the story? So Prabhupada wrote back. At that time, those sannyasis and their group were giving at least $100,000 a month for the building project. And Prabhupada said that, first of all, he said, why do you want to worship a demigod? Why not just worship Krishna? Why worship a demigod? And he quoted Bhagavad Gita, he referred to the Bhagavad Gita, the verses that we're talking about now. And they said, but if your plan, which this was their plan, we'll worship Ganesh and we'll make a lot of money to give to you too, Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, then you can do, but you have to give at least $100,000 a month. And then he said, and not a farthing less. You can worship Ganesh, remember that? So, yes.
There's also one verse in Bhagavad Gita.
Wait, we got to finish this one first. Hold on to that. Yanti de yepianya devata bhakta yajante shodayanvita tepi mam eva kaunteya yajantya vidipurvaka. Remember this, and if you get a tattoo on the way home, it should be a 9:23 right on your arm right here. Scroll down. Don't take that seriously. Those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith actually worship only me, O son of Kunti, but they do so in a wrong way. I mean, how much more clear can you get? All right, go ahead with your pramanam. Yeah.
Similarly, I found one verse in Bhagavad Gita 8.16 where Krishna says, O banna bhayani loka puna andirta arjuna mamapante te kontaye puna janana vidyate. That means from the highest planets in the material world, down to the lowest, all other places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. But what else do you know about, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again.
What have you proved?
This I wanted to prove that why Krishna is supreme, because we are mentioning about that why Krishna is different from demigod, in what context. The same quote I want to mention, that Krishna is supreme because if you go demigod or you go to any other planet of demigod, you do take birth again, because even they are dying, but Krishna is supreme, he's not dying.
I like just that wanted evidence. To. I'm really convinced. You know, it's actually very convincing, and when one's convinced, then one can give one's full attention to Krishna. As if somebody's convinced, Krishna says, Aham sarvasya pravavo matak sarvam pravartite iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. If you're convinced that Krishna is everything, everyone emanates from Krishna, he's the source of everything, and everything's possible in Krishna. Things aren't quite possible in the material world. If you meditate on demigods, eventually it'll unravel, no matter what you get. And no matter how hard you work to build something up here, it'll fall apart. But with Krishna, everything's possible. And if you have this clear understanding and you're able to just give your full heart and attention to Krishna, then life becomes sublime. And surrender becomes very sweet, because you realize that actually this is the real happiness in life, is just thinking of Krishna and depending on Krishna all the time. So you've all given really good, strong evidence. And the problem with the world today is that people don't know Bhagavad Gita. They say they know Bhagavad Gita, but either the Bhagavad Gita they have has been misinterpreted, or they just didn't read it. They carry it around or keep it in their house, and they say, I know Bhagavad Gita, but if you ask them what Bhagavad Gita is about, they'll tell you something that's very un-Bhagavad Gita-like, and say, pass it off as Bhagavad Gita, because that's what people do when they're undisciplined and they get bad association with people who are not spiritually educated, which requires that one has a guru in disciplic succession. And when you have that, then you can get the Bhagavad Gita as it is. And that's the solution to all problems in life. And there are no other solutions besides that. Would you concur, or do you disagree with my last statement?
Can I play devil's advocate here?
Yeah, sure.
So, Mayavad, Maya means illusion, right? And Vad means a teaching. So their whole teaching hinges on this point that there is no material world. It's an illusion. There's no creation, so therefore there's no creator. So how can you defeat that? Where does it explain that the material world, although our association with the material world is illusory, the material physical world itself is real, but the Mayavadis say, no, it's not real.
Then I would appreciate it on this auspicious day that you donate all the money that you have right now, because it doesn't really exist anyway. I don't believe that. I believe it's real, and I would like to engage it in Krishna service now, but because you believe that, I would like you to prove your belief by handing over that money. You have a safe at home. You say it's all Brahman, whether it's inside or outside, so we would like you to open that safe and let that Brahman out. And we will take it and engage in Krishna service. Will you comply or not?
You got me. But how about from Scripture? I mean, that's logic.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, if we look in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we'll find the definition of Maya given by Krishna himself. And Krishna describes, Ritirtam yat pratyeta na pratyeta chatmani tadvidyadatmano mayam yatabhaso yatatamaha. That anything that you see that doesn't have relation to me, know that to be my illusory energy. That's the actual definition of Maya given by Shastra. And the idea that Maya doesn't exist is not tenable, because in whose mind doesn't it exist? Now, this was something that Radhika brought up, because the example is given by our acharyas of the rope and the snake. And so the example that Shankaracharya gives is that you walk out and you see at night what you think is a snake, but it's actually a rope. But still, because you thought it was a snake, you jump. Now he says that's the example, the parallel to what you're saying is Maya doesn't actually exist. It's not really there. So they say that's what's not really there, and it is that misidentification with the rope being a snake. That's ethereal, it's not really existing. But then he says a couple of points, that one of them is that how would you be afraid of a rope and think it's a snake if a snake didn't really exist? In other words, how is there an illusion if there's not something to be an illusion of? Right?
Yeah.
And do you remember the rope and the snake? Yes. So that it's not a an example that, yeah, go ahead. You were what? You were just stretching? Okay. So ultimately their metaphor doesn't work actually, because the snake and the rope actually exist. And that's why you'd be afraid of a rope anyway, is because a real snake exists. Otherwise, why would you be afraid of it in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So now we'll take some reflections. Anything that you've heard so far that you want to elaborate?
Maharaj, I like that how you told that even in the biology book, when you open the first two, you'll find that how the evolution has taken so much, like all the self-help book, everything.
Yes.
On the last weekend, Radha Vallabh Prabhu, the cook devotee who is here. So, and then he was preparing for some corporate presentation, and one of the slides, it was for Rajogun, and then he put the picture of onion and garlic. So we told Prabhu, it's like everyone will shout on you if you are putting onion and garlic there. So he told that, yeah, that's what I wanted to prove, that like onion and garlic has taken more space in all the cuisines. It's not that we need onion and garlic. It's just like everyone is putting onion and garlic. There's other taste also can be taken, but it has overtaken the space of in the food, just because I don't know who has started, but it just got spread out everywhere. So he wanted to tell that, okay, there are other thing also you can replace with that. That's why he's putting there in the slide. So as you told, like information has to be, like we have to spread this information to people. It's the duty.
Yes. There's a way in which if we don't have in our own life the positive practices of devotional service, then by default we'll take to the negative activities of the material world, because we'll be compelled by the modes of material nature. So one has to work hard, actually, to overcome the default mode of impersonalism. This is another point Radhika made. He said it's a natural default in this material world to take to impersonalism. And until one actually practices personalism through devotional service and comes to realize that everything's connected to the Supreme Person and everything's a part of his energy, then naturally we'll be pulled in that direction. Nice. What other reflections do you all have? Oh, good. Balaram.
The verse that we saw right before this, 7:24, that really stuck to me. It said, unintelligent men who do not know me perfectly think that I, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, was impersonal before and have now assumed this personality. Due to their small knowledge, they do not know my higher nature, which is imperishable and supreme. And I think it connects to what Radhika Ramaprabhu was saying, that how Mayavads describe an avatar, where Krishna was impersonal, but then he's taking a body or like a form just for some time, a temporary body. So, and Krishna here completely disintegrates the argument, because he just says they're unintelligent men. So I found that very nice.
Such perfect application, and it cuts right through that disastrous conclusion that actually when the avatar comes, it's actually a manifestation of the three modes of material nature. And that ultimately what we're looking for is beyond that. And this was described in Prabhupada's poem to his spiritual master, he said, impersonal calamity thou hast removed. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati appreciated that statement in Prabhupada's poem, that the impersonal idea is a calamity. It leads to a calamitous conclusion of I'm God or there is no God and so forth. And that leads to rampant materialism, because there's nowhere else to take shelter, because you can't surrender to anybody. And it ultimately pollutes your heart and it pollutes the environment. It leads to the kind of situation we have in the world today is the case that Radhika Raman Prabhu was making. Yes, there were more Katakarnika, the source of all entertainment. That's very personal, personal name. Krishna is the source of all entertainment.
Maharaj, I was thinking about chapter 10, verse 2.
Yes.
Where Krishna says, Name Vidu Suragana Prabhavam Na Maharishya Ahamadehi Devanam Maharishi Nam Chasarvisha, that neither the hosts of demigods nor the great sages know my original opulences, for in every respect I am the source of the demigods and sages. So I thought this is a good
very good. For excellent. Now, when we go to the Bhagavat philosophy, we understand that God has several features. Advaita Gyan Tattva. In other words, absolute truth is one, but he expresses himself in three features. Verse, please. It's from the first canto, second chapter. It's text number 11. But I want the Pundit Pit to recite this verse, because it's an extremely important verse for evidence about one supreme, three features. All right, it's open book. Go ahead. Just get the mic. As long as you recite it, and you're the more aware of it you become.
Vedanti tat tatva vidas tatvam yajgyanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavan iti shabdyate.
Give us the translation. Thank you.
Learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan.
Yes. And now I'd like to bring our attention to a verse in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a practical application of this. It's spoken by Shukadev Goswami when he's observing Krishna playing with his friends. Itam satam brahma sukhana bhutya. Could you look up that verse? It's in the Bhagavatam. Itam satam brahma sukhana bhutya. 10. Dasyam gatanam naradaya kena mayashutanam. 10, 12, 11. 7, 10, 12, 7-11. This is a verse that's quoted frequently. You'll find it. That's not it. Yeah, keep going down. There it is. Itam satam, back up, last verse. Itam satam, I'll say please repeat. Itam satam brahma sukhanu bhutya.
Itam satam brahma sukhanu bhutya.
Dasyam gatanam paradaivatena.
Dasyam gatanam paradaivatena.
Mayashitanam naradarakena.
Mayashitanam naradarakena.
Sakam vrajaru krita punya punjaha. Sakam Rajavu Krita Punya Punjaha.
Sakam
Rajavu
Krita Punya Punjaha.
Sakam
Rajavu
Krita Punya
Punjaha.
Itam Satam Brahma Sukhanu Bhutya. Dasyam Gatanam Paradaivatena. Mayashitanam Naradarakena. Sakam Vrajaru Krita Punya Punjaha.
Sakam
Vrajaru Krita Punya Punjaha. And now we'll look at the word for word at the very bottom. Okay. Itam. Itam. In this way. Satam. Of the transcendentalists. Brahma Sukha Anubhutya.
Brahma Sukha Anubhutya.
with Krishna, the source of Brahmasukha. Krishna is part of Brahman, and from him originates his personal effulgence. Dasyam, servitorship. Gatanam, of the devotees who have accepted. Paradaivatena, with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Maya Ashritanam, for those who are in the clutches of material energy. Naradarakena, with him who is like an ordinary child. Sakam, along with Vijavu, enjoyed. Kritapunya Punjaha, all these boys who had accumulated the results of life after life of pious activities. Now I'm going to read the whole English translation. All the boys would be differently engaged. Some boys blew their flutes and others blew bugles made of horn. Some imitated the buzzing of the bumblebees and others imitated the voice of the cuckoo. Some boys imitated flying birds by running after the birds' shadows on the ground. Some imitated the beautiful movements and attractive postures of the swans. Some sat down with the ducks, sitting silently, and others imitated the dancing of the peacocks. Some boys attracted young monkeys in the trees. Some jumped into the trees, imitating the monkeys. Some made faces at the monkeys. Some made faces as the monkeys were accustomed to do, and others jumped from one branch to another. Some boys went to the waterfalls and crossed over the river, jumping with the frogs, and when they saw their own reflections on the water, they would laugh. They would also condemn the sounds of their own echoes. In this way, all the cowherd boys used to play with Krishna, who is the source of the Brahman effulgence for Gyanis, desiring to merge into that effulgence, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead for devotees who have accepted eternal servitorship, and who for ordinary persons is but another ordinary child. The cowherd boys, having accumulated the results of pious activities for many lives, were able to associate in this way with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. How can one explain their good fortune? This explains how there are various features of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Satyadev Prabhu, you make a comment. Oh, I thought you were moving the mic in position. And so in the Gita, Krishna says, Ye yata mam prapadyante tamstatayava bhajamyaham mama vartmanavartante manusha parta sarvasha. That as a devotee surrenders to me, I reveal myself accordingly. I reward him accordingly. And there's one Supreme Personality of Godhead, but people, as they interact with him in various ways, have varied realizations. And where is another example of this? In Krishna's pastimes, where various people saw Krishna, same Krishna, but they saw him in varied ways.
The arena of Kamsa.
The arena of Kamsa, is that what you were going to say? Okay. Do you want to take us through that, anybody? The arena of Kamsa?
When Krishna entered Dwaraka, different people were seeing him as differently. Kamsa saw him as enemy, personification of death. The young girls were seeing him as a lover. The mothers were seeing him as a child. And his parents were seeing him as a child as well.
What about the yogis?
They were seeing him as the Parabrahman, like the person.
They saw him as Paramatma. You know, that looking, there's Krishna. He's each person appears differently, but it's very striking, the yogis there. It's like, oh, there's Paramatma walking around. So he reveals himself, although he's one, he reveals himself differently according to the mood of the person who's approaching, right? So various aspects of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Other reflections? Yes.
So I was just contemplating on the first point which you made of like we should always do the activities which are favorable for devotional service.
Yes.
And you were making the point in this regard, like a person who wants to learn the kung fu and he watches the movies of kung fu, and it's like he's associating with the people who are who like kung fu and these things. Similarly, I was thinking on the parallel, Prabhupada writes again and again, like how if a person forgets his memory, and to remind him again, people take him to the places which are by which he can recover his memory. And so, and in addition, you were mentioning like how we, by circumlating Tulsi Maharani, we, by smelling her, we can get, we experience a soothing, and we experience a different amount of satisfaction. And lastly, like you mentioned about like how Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur in all Gaudiya Mutts put like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's lotus feet and says that people can experience. So I was just contemplating, I had just had a talk with my friend who was there in New Vrindavan this morning. So he was telling how Prabhupada has done the same thing by creating different places like Vrindavan, yes, in this whole world. So
yes, in fact, you know the verse Nikunjayu no rati keli sidya yayali bir yuktira pekshaniya tatrati daksya rati balabasya vande guru shri charanaravindam, describing how the guru is enjoying the setting arrangements in the kunjas. These means like this very rasika kind of description, because Krishna in Vrindavan and the way that the devotees worship him there is very intimate, and there are various kinds of forest scenes and little bowers, little kunjas where they can go, and Krishna has intimate connections with his devotees there in various rasas. And so I just remember we were discussing this verse, and there was a devotee who made the comment that actually Prabhupada had created these kunjas everywhere in the world. So if you look at the altar and you see Radha Krishna, how they're there each day, the flowers are there, the flutes there, you know, often the backdrops are depicting the forest scene and so forth. This is a kunj. And there's a way in which the whole temple is centered around this, that Radha and Krishna are in the kunj, and that the devotees are worshipping that and creating that environment for Radha and Krishna. And so this is kind of the realization of this verse of how Prabhupada had done that also all over the world. It can be in the middle of New York City, right? You just came from New York, and there you can be at Shri Radha Muralidhar. There you hear sirens going by all the time. In New York City, it's constant sirens and all kinds of noise from the street. But then you're right there in the sanctified atmosphere of Kunj, right in Vrindavan, that was created because it manifests from the heart of a pure devotee, and then Krishna will manifest in various places, especially because his intention was to reveal that to the whole world so people could see. Sayyide Prabhu, before we have a kirtan, would you give some concluding, very practical advice to the body of devotees about how they might feel really, well, whatever you want to say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, just give a few concluding sentences to our conversation here on Wednesday Night Live.
Well, I think one thing that became very apparent in our discussion is that the world needs accurate spiritual knowledge. That's the real cure for this misguided civilization. And we know from our own experience of coming to Krishna consciousness, we were very confused about what is the self and what is, maybe you weren't, but I was. Is there God? What is God? And there's a lot of fake news out there and a lot of disinformation coming from so many different sources. And if someone can get accurate knowledge, even the Christian, I mean, you can go to any group. It's just there's just such a lack of clear information about what is the soul, what is God, what is the material world, and what is our purpose here. But as soon as we have that accurate knowledge, that still to this day I've really only, I don't want to sound like a born-again Christian, that we have somehow, I think we have the corner on spiritual knowledge, but there are not too many sources out there that clearly explain what is the self, what is the super self, how can you distinguish that. And once you have that knowledge, then everything becomes clear. And without that, we're like handicapped spiritually. And so Srila Prabhupada's books are the real cure for the disease of ignorance. And
would you say that is the greatest or one of the greatest assets that we have in the Krishna conscious movement is accurate knowledge, which is systematically presented, and especially in book form?
Yeah.
I know you had a great fondness for Sri Shapanishad, that you used to buy cases of it and distribute them around your neighborhood and elsewhere.
Well, that was the first book that I read that really convinced me. They just brought clarity for me. But that clarity is there in any one of Srila Prabhupada's books. Wherever you read, he's going to explain how we're a pure spiritual beings and that we come from the Supreme Being. And if we want to find happiness, is to surrender to that Supreme Being.
It's uncanny, isn't it?
I mean, it doesn't matter. You read wherever you read.
Right. Yeah. That's my follow-up point. It's uncanny that Prabhupada was able to so deliberately and expansively give this knowledge in so many different literatures from many different angles of philosophy and in such a short amount of time to make it available to us in the world, right?
Yeah. So, for myself, I just want to appreciate that every day and do my little part.
I like Satyadeva Prabhu's practice of expressing gratitude to a picture of Srila Prabhupada every day. It sounds like a really good way to start the day, doesn't it? If you can try that. And also, this practice of distributing Sri Shapanishad. If you have faith in a book, it makes a lot of sense to distribute it, kind of increase it, amplifies that faith by giving it to other people as well. That's also a really nice practice. Thank you very much, Satyadeva Prabhu, for joining us here at Wednesday Night Live. And let's give him a hand for So, we had an opportunity to read from the Bhagavad Gita as it is. That's not ordinary. And we also engaged in a conversation that is meant to sharpen our skills at remembering the specific evidence that Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita to direct us towards Krishna bhakti, and dissuade us from falling into the morass of the material conception, which is troublesome, Krishna says in the Gita, klesho dikartaraste sham avyakta sakta chetasam. And we also heard from Satyadeva Prabhu personal testimonials of how he came to Krishna consciousness, quite extraordinary. We got some inkling about the beginnings of the Krishna consciousness movement in which devotees would utilize anything to get a foothold in a city, for instance, getting a funeral home and establishing it into a proper temple. That's the temple I joined in, the funeral home. And we also got an inkling for the power of the philosophy that pervades Prabhupada's books. It is authorized, is presented by an effulgent, self-effulgent acharya who's come in the line of disciplic succession. And it gives us a little more impetus to absorb ourselves therein, take advantage of the greatest asset that we have. So we're walking away, I know I am, uplifted by the conversation, more determined to practice Krishna bhakti, take advantage of those things that are favorable, and to be careful about not falling into the habits that are unfavorable to devotional service. And such a lifestyle is a lifestyle of Sharanagati, taking shelter of Krishna. And we thank everybody who joined us here. It took quite a bit of doing just to get here into this atmosphere today. And just driving through the streets of Silicon Valley is not so easy. And also for everyone who joined us online from various places around ISV, apparently, and around the world, we thank you very much for joining us online. Everyone like to say Hare Krishna to all the devotees online. I'm sure they'll be happy. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Vancha kalpadrishya kripasanabhevacha patitanam pavanibhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha nantakodi vaishnavindiki jai.
Natchari arman. Hey! Natchari arman.